Coming up on Tech News Today, the shadow brokers release their cache of NSA spy tools for everyone. Minecraft Marketplace boosts Pocket Edition players with new add-ons. Phone calls are not coming to an airplane near you. Kurt Wagner from Recode keeps it real when it comes to Twitter's dedication to free speech. And Google's AI just can't quit Go. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1743, recorded Monday, April 10th, 2017.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. See what's on the menu this week and get three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/TNT. Hey!
Oh, hi, there you are. I didn't see you come in.
Welcome to Tech News Today. This is a show where we tell you everything you need to know about technology. I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. So what was your favorite record that your parents had in their record collection when you were a kid?
Well, when I was a kid, it was Chorus Line. But that was my record. And there was Blondie, which I thought was mine, but was probably my sister's. Mm-hmm. But my parents had some Waylon Jennings. Mm-hmm. They had some Beatles. Mm-hmm. They had some Kenny Rogers. We lived in Texas, after all. The one that I remember most, they had the Yoko Ono album, or maybe it was the
Double Fantasy.
Is it one she's laying down?
I was thinking of the John Lennon Yoko Ono Double Fantasy.
It might have been, because that one was the most, like, it was salacious.
It was like, ooh, I can't believe they have this in there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Electric Light Orchestra. That's the one that I remember.
Oh.
And that's a great one to go back to, by the way.
Yeah.
We just started this randomly. Like, we went back to a conversation that we had prior to the show and just jumped into it for kicks. Mm-hmm. I hope you enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. You should let us know what record your parents had in their record collection when you were growing
up. Fats Domino.
Really?
Classic. Yeah. That's my grandparents, actually.
That's solid. I was going to say.
That's solid. Let's talk about some tech news now. Last August, a hacking group calling themselves the Shadow Brokers released small samples of code purporting to belong to a much larger collection of NSA spying tools that were somehow stolen from the agency's servers. It was big news to think that the National Security Agency could lose such a big score to unknown hackers. And ultimately, the Shadow Brokers put the Equation Group code up for auction, aiming for the stars with around $7 million in Bitcoin, but only receiving, in the end, around $9,000. So over the weekend, the Shadow Brokers gave up on the auction and instead released the password to the encrypted collection for all of the world to see now. And security researchers kind of spent the weekend poring over what was to be found inside. Apparently much of that cache included dated code targeting very outdated systems, a lot of Linux, some of the stuff dating as far back as the 1990s. So, I mean, I think to a large degree, rather unimpressive.
Yeah, I feel a little bit like the Shadow Brokers because I had all this furniture and when I moved, I put it all on Craigslist and nobody bought it. And so like then I just had to give it away and leave it on the street. So it's sort of the same thing.
Oh, totally. Yes. We should come up with a name for you that isn't Shadow Brokers, but is related. Somebody in chat will work on that while we're talking. But they basically took this post to Medium. Highly politicized post. I mean, they're basically saying, you know, they took issue with President Trump's kind of his first days in his tenure in office, and particularly with the recent missile attack in Syria, missile strikes. And so there's a lot of people kind of wondering how this relates to kind of the greater, you know, the greater questions around Russia, let's say, not to get into political waters too much, but there are people kind of drawing connections between the Shadow Brokers and all that stuff going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that most security experts say this probably either comes from the Russians or the Chinese, and then, you know, for sure it's someone trying to pretend they're Russian if they aren't Russian.
Right. You know? They're doing a really good job of not writing perfect English, you know what I
right.
mean?
Right, and also just releasing this in, you know, at the same time that Putin said, you know, right, like with our attacks on Syria. So, I mean, I think one of the most important things about this is just knowing how it implies that the government, the U.S. government, had these you know, knew about this for a long time. Like, they knew about these Linux vulnerabilities and didn't do anything about them. That's some of the implications. I was reading what I like to read what Bruce Schneier says usually when things like this happen. He says, you know, pretty much now they have enough information to know exactly where the data comes from and how they got it and when they got, not where it came from necessarily, but how they got it and when they got it. And maybe some detailed information about how, about who did it, but, you know, we'll never know.
Yeah, there's a lot of clues in there. Edward Snowden also on Twitter kind of came to the same conclusion. There's ample clues as far as where the cache actually came from, but he also indicated this is nowhere near the entire library, the full library. I mean, they have a lot of kind of information pointing to this former NSA contractor, Harold Martin, who when they arrested him late last year and did a raid, they found 50 plus terabytes of stolen data. It was almost like he was hoarding this information. They've drawn some connections between those things. I found it kind of humorous that, like, you have all of these NSA tools that, I mean, on its surface, when we heard about this last year, that really seemed like it would have a lot of value, yet when it came down to it, couldn't get more than $9,000 in an auction on it. And I just find that I never would have guessed that. Like, I would have imagined that there would have been a high price tag for something like this. And what does that say of where we are at now, how insecure even the NSA's servers are, to the point to where it has little value that these tools are even out there?
Mm-hmm.
Very strange.
Minecraft will soon become the most capitalist city made of blocks ever. The company announced the Minecraft Marketplace coming this spring to your phone or tablet. The Marketplace will allow creators to sell their skins, textures, worlds, and more so players can support artists. As long as they're in the Minecraft Partner Program, developers are free to set their own price for stuff. So they're also launching their own currency. It's called Minecraft Coins. They'll start with 9 businesses selling new storylines and game activities, landscapes, and then they'll expand in the coming months. Of course, Minecraft already has a store. It already exists, but it's limited to the Minecraft dev team, so this will open it up a little bit wider.
Yeah, and kind of open things up for Pocket Edition, which has always kind of been seen as like a more limited mobile version. I mean, it's also for Windows 10 here, but Pocket Edition is what really benefits here, because when you got Pocket Edition on your Android or iOS device, I mean, you're pretty much limited to the things that are sold in app. And here is kind of a level of expandability that's being offered to those players that players on other platforms have enjoyed for a long time with kind of expandability in different ways. But this isn't actually opening up to everyone. It's really going to be targeting registered businesses to create for that marketplace, 70% cut of revenue to the merchant in that exchange. But not everybody, you know, like not just a random person. I'm going to create some content and put it up there and make 70% off the sale. It doesn't necessarily work like that.
Right. And that's a good thing, too, because that's the sketchiest thing. That is actually the sketchiest thing that my 12-year-old twins download that I know of is the Minecraft skins. Because, like, we don't really know where they come from. You know, they learn about them on YouTube and I'm like, oh, I don't know. Like, I got to look at that. And because it's not just like, you know, you're buying a sweater on Etsy or something. This is something that you're, you know, putting into your computer, into your system or your mobile device. So I'm glad that it's
a pixelated sweater. A heavily pixelated sweater
made of blocks. Yes.
I mean, are those add-ons expensive?
Not necessarily. I mean, what is, you know, they're like $3.99, $4.99. Is that expensive? Okay. Sometimes I don't know. No. Well, they find the free ones, which is when it gets sketchy.
Right. That's like, yeah, exactly. You got to kind of wonder, why is it free?
Mm-hmm.
If you were hoping to someday be able to turn your airplane into a telephone booth, it looks like you might be waiting indefinitely. FCC Chairman Ajit Pai has proposed to cancel a possible lifting of the ban on in-flight calls. That was originally floated by former Chairman Tom Wheeler back in 2013. Wheeler argued then that airplanes now have their own cell phone towers for onboard entertainment, and as such, calls from inside the plane would have no ill effects on ground-based relay stations trying to communicate with the pilots who are inside. Pai says the action would be a victory for Americans who, quote, value a moment of quiet at 30,000 feet, which, I mean, can be backed up by a lot of feedback from just people. I guess U.S. Transportation Department received more than 1,700 comments on the ban. 96% of all of those favored banning cell phones or keeping the ban on cell phones in flight.
I am of two minds on this.
Oh, yeah?
Well, first of all, people don't really make calls anymore, do they? I mean, is that still a thing with your cell phone?
But if they can, maybe they will. I don't know. No, it's true. I mean, there's a lot less calls happening, but mm-hmm. I can't think of a place that I would not want calls more than sitting right next to somebody on an airplane.
Right. Yeah, I don't want this either. But I mean, I think the idea is that allowing a competition among wireless providers, the airlines could make money off of it. That's
for sure.
Part of it.
Yep.
I definitely don't want people like the bus, you know, I don't want people calling all the time, but you know, it's also one of those things where you never really knew why it was. Like, it always just seemed like you're just saying you can't use your cell phone. Like, it was the way they approached it. Like, they made it seem like if you tried to use your cell phone in the middle of a flight, the flight was
going to
crash.
Yeah, you were going to doom the flight to suddenly strike the ground. Two out of three chairmen basically were publicly opposed to the rule. So at this point, it still needs to be voted on. It's practically guaranteed, though. FCC chairman, is it Mingnan Clyburn, mm-hmm. the third? He was not opposing the rule all along. He basically argued, like you said, that this would be better for consumers. It would drive competition. You know, airlines could choose for themselves whether they allow for it. And maybe in doing so, that drives down the cost of flights that don't allow for it versus do. And so, you know, everybody would win from that perspective. But
Mingnan Clyburn was a chairperson, or otherwise known as a chairwoman.
Oh, there we go. That's better. Getting it right is probably probably the right way to go.
Okay. You're welcome. New research by Piper Jaffray says 55% of U.S. teens don't feel they need for a cable or satellite TV subscription. They say they spend 38% of their time on Netflix, 26% of their time on YouTube, and only 23% on cable TV. And 81% of all U.S. teens check Snapchat once a month, or more likely 800 billion times a month, compared to the 79% of all teens who are monthly active users of Instagram. So that's what the kids are doing these days, apparently. 81% also say their next phone will be an iPhone. Mm-hmm. So that's up from the 75% that say they have an iPhone now. But it may be that people are just saying their next phone is going to be an iPhone. We don't know if it really is. That mm-hmm. might just be what
aspirational.
Kids say. Aspirational, yeah. Exactly.
We know which one they would like to have.
Right.
We'll see which one their mom and dad let them have.
Exactly. And Business Insider also cites another study that says only 8% of U.S. college students do not have a Netflix account.
That's insane. That's,
yeah, I know.
Wow, crazy. That's mm-hmm. that's some crazy penetration for Netflix. I mean, yeah, this is just a different time right now, right? Like with the kids that are growing up with the internet and you know, kind of content distribution online right now, it's just a different world, right? Like we are kind of the transitional generation that understood and kind of looked forward to programming live on TV. I mean, when I think of my kids, and mind you, they are very young, they're way underneath any of these studies. I mean, the only thing they know is streaming online and on demand, and live means absolutely nothing mm-hmm. to them. And I'm sure, and that's now, think of another 10 years down the line when even more things are in this on demand world. Like, yeah, this is these numbers are probably I'm sure cable has recognized this already, but this is a big wake-up call for them. And you're going to see more of this.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the YouTube TV is a big deal. I am frustrated with it just because it's got ads all over the place. Like, and, you know, I mean, I think, of course, advertising supports content. But even in the DVR stuff, there are ads and you can't skip them. It's hard to skip them. And so, you know, that's a change. For me, like part of my cord cutting was being able to avoid ads. Like we mm-hmm. would just use Netflix, you know, we would just ads will find a way, as they said, to paraphrase Jurassic Park. Ads will find a way.
We all know that saw from Jurassic Park. I mean, YouTube TV is a prime example of these services realizing that there is still a need that's met by live programming. And so they're working it in. Like, I wonder if at some point we'll ever see Netflix kind of do something similar because there is a piece of the pie that is missing out. And now YouTube has a piece of that pie. And now I'm thinking about pie. And I want some pie. I'm going to stop thinking about pie now. So I wonder if Netflix kind of does that as well. Or maybe that's so far out of their trajectory right now because they're doing a lot of other things perfectly right, as evidenced by the study.
Right. Well, it's crazy to think that Netflix is, you know, $10 a month. No ads, and YouTube TV is $35 a month.
Right.
And ads. I mean, I understand that you're getting a ton more channels, but in my opinion, like, there's nothing on all those channels that's worth it.
Well, and it's the ability to stay current. Like Netflix, yes, it's $10 and no ads, but a lot of the content, I mean, outside of Netflix's, you know, exclusive content that they create, mm-hmm. original content, you know, anything that's like series from TVs, you're talking about seasons that are long in the past. And mm-hmm. so maybe that's the tax of staying current, you know, being able to watch something that's now and not last season right. because it just appeared on Netflix in entire, you know, form.
I mean, what I would like to know is a real breakdown of like, are teenagers watching mostly Netflix or are they mostly watching their friends' stories on Snapchat? You know, or like doing their own thing. And then what does that mean? Like if you're not watching like created content versus you're just watching like your friends, you know, walking down the street or their shoes mm-hmm. or at a party or, you know, just stuff. Like what does that mean for the, I don't know, I'm getting into the think of the children.
What does that mean for commercial content creators who, I mean, and not just talking about cable TV programming, but all content creators, if the majority of what people are watching are other people's random little snippets of their life.
Right. Well, I was thinking, that's true. Like, what does it mean to people who create content?
But I think,
content?
Yeah, eventually they probably move on from that.
Right.
You know, need something more substantive.
Right. I would hope so. I mean, that's what I've seen in my own home. But I mean, what I meant yeah. really was, what about kids? Because, I mean, I think, like, fictional stories is how we learn to be people, whether it's a novel or, you know, a Netflix series or whatever, you know, that's how mm-hmm. you learn empathy, not necessarily by just like watching someone's dumb Snapchat story. But maybe I'm being judgmental.
Maybe we just don't, parents just don't understand.
True. We should rename the show that.
There we go. That could be the title. Chinese smartphone and electronics company LeEco announced that its plan to acquire Vizio for $2 billion will not move forward, citing regulatory headwinds, quote in quotes, regulatory headwinds. LeEco first announced their plans last July, but have since clashed with regulators in China over currency restrictions and other reasons. The two companies instead announced a new partnership to bring LeEco software into Vizio products, as well as bringing Vizio products to the Chinese market. Vizio will, at least for the time being, stay an independent U.S. company that has done has been a pretty big success story in the world of TVs.
Versus LeEco that appears to be like making a bunch of promises and then breaking most of them.
Yeah, LeEco, I mean, they've had a crazy, I mean, even like a compacted like 8 months or 6 to 8 months, right? Like they had that big announce, that big event. They really went all out for this U.S. event, you know, I think it was like last August or something, where they showed off a smartphone and VR, and they showed off their electric autonomous, you know, vehicle concept. They've invested, they're funding Faraday Future, which we've talked about on the show many times, the Android bike that they showed. I mean, all these crazy things. And then within like a week, a week or two later, had this public statement where they said, we're cutting back on expansion because it's not working and we're losing money and we're really afraid. It's like, wait a minute, these two things don't add up. This really looked like you were just going for it. Mm-hmm. You know, and they had already announced the buyout of Vizio. So it really seemed like they had this aggressive plan and they just did not plan very well for it.
Yeah, that's what it seems
plan
like.
Plan in air quotes.
Yeah, the outside, sure. So, I mean, they're blaming it on regulations. It could be anything. I mean, it could have
been part of it.
They're going through, a lot of cash. So, yeah, I guess it's now just a partnership where right. the app will appear on some Le devices.
Le app. Oh, man. I mean, even co-founder of the company called this, just its challenges with money, signs of big company disease. Oh. Called a disease. And at that point, you're like, okay, well, then what's going right here? And now Vizio, the deal has fizzled. So just add that to the list.
Well, after the break, Kurt Wagner from Recode is here to talk about Twitter's long history of protecting anonymous users. But first, let's take a minute to thank Blue Apron, the sponsor of this episode. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with fresh, high-quality ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. If you spend a lot of time at restaurants or high-end grocery chains, you can now spend under $10 per person for a delicious meal. Not all ingredients are created equal, so it's important to know where your food comes from. Blue Apron sets the highest quality standards for their community of over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. And by shipping the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, Blue Apron is reducing food waste. Their freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they will make it right. Blue Apron delivers to 99% of the continental U.S. And there's no weekly commitment, so you can get deliveries when you want them. Customize your recipes every week based on your dietary preferences and choose from a variety of new recipes each week, or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, so you will never get bored. We made a chicken and fettuccine last week. It was delicious. I don't eat chicken, so I just ate the fettuccine, and that was delicious. My family ate the chicken. They loved it. The house smelled like French fries. Everybody wins. Spinach and fresh mozzarella pizza is on the menu this week with olives, bell peppers, and ricotta salata. Sweet and sour salmon with bok choy, carrot and ginger fried rice, Parmesan crusted chicken. That was what we had, the Parmesan crusted chicken, which makes your house smell like French fries. That's Megan's guarantee.
Yeah, we had that too.
And creamy fettuccine and roasted broccoli. Did your children eat the broccoli? My children ate the broccoli.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. My kids love broccoli.
Yeah. My kids
don't
love
broccoli. It's one of the few green vegetables that they do love.
They don't love it unless it's filled with creamy. It's on top of creamy fettuccine. It's sort of hidden there. Baby broccoli and fontina paninis with hard-boiled egg and arugula salad. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/TNT. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. Don't wait. Go to blueapron.com/TNT. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Last week, Twitter sued the U.S. government to protect the identity of one of its users. This is nothing new, says Kurt Wagner from Recode, who's joining us to talk about it. Welcome back to the show, Kurt.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Awesome.
Doing well. So Twitter revealed last week that the Department of Homeland Security had compelled them to reveal the identity of an account that had been posting critical tweets about the president's policies. Now, the government rescinded their request and Twitter withdrew its suit. You say they've done this in the past. Tell us a little bit about some of the times they've done this before.
Yeah, they have. Twitter has long been kind of this champion of free speech and protecting the idea of an anonymous internet user, which is why I guess their accounts don't require you to authenticate, a real name, similar to like what Facebook would do. There's a number of examples, and I mentioned them in that story that I wrote there about them kind of taking legal action or at the very least pushing back on these kinds of requests. And they get thousands of requests, every year to go ahead and give away kind of user information, which could be emails or phone numbers or actual names associated with accounts that maybe you or I couldn't see. And they claim that, about 40% of those, they either just simply don't comply with or they give less information than was originally asked. And then in a few unique cases, they'll actually take legal action to try and defend a user if they feel like information is being requested unfairly. And so I guess the point of the story was kind of point out that we made a big deal about this, this suit last week, and rightfully so. It was very kind of interesting and generated a lot of attention, but it's not necessarily unique to where Twitter stands on this whole issue.
So you've been following the company and its founders for a long time. What can you point to something that makes them so interested in this idea of anonymous free speech?
Yeah, I think part of it has to just do with the way that Twitter was founded and who the founders were and where they, where they kind of rest on this spectrum. Personally, I think like when we look at CEO Jack Dorsey, he's clearly been a big fan of kind of letting free speech flow. And I think he takes a lot of pride in the fact that Twitter is a platform that enables that. I think when we've looked at how they've handled abuse on the platform in the past, There was a story, I want to say it was maybe in BuzzFeed. It was really well reported, just kind of the history of Twitter's abuse problem. And it goes back to show that for years, there have been kind of two camps inside Twitter, those who believe that free speech needs to be defended at all costs, and those who kind of believe that, free speech can only go so far. And there's a certain point where Twitter needs to come in and say, these things are inappropriate, regardless if people feel that their rights are being trampled on. So This has just kind of been like Twitter's thing for a really long time. And I think that they see themselves, especially in today's day and age where there's so many protests and there's a lot of movements that happen, I think Twitter feels like the platform for those people. And I don't think that they want to, go away from that, because Facebook certainly doesn't feel that way. So Twitter is kind of, it fills that void.
You mentioned in the article that, this has happened a decent amount of times where this kind of outcome of, a legal challenge comes along, Twitter pushes back, and, they do it in kind of the sense of free speech. But a lot of times you don't hear about it. But in this case, I mean, it was very public. Why did they take this one public? Was that kind of a bargaining tool or kind of like a tool to kind of push it into the public to the point to where it adds pressure so that we get the outcome that we got? And why does that not happen in other situations?
That's actually a really good question. I'm going to embarrass myself here because I don't have the right answer to that. I don't know why this one was able to be shared publicly, while in the past I'm kind of told that a lot of these interactions are actually under seal by the court. So A, that means Twitter's not allowed to talk about them, and B, that whole process kind of happens behind the scenes. And I'm not exactly sure why this one was different. That's actually a great question. I should try to find that out. But clearly, I think that the public pressure did have an influence here, because as soon as we found out that Twitter was suing the government, there were a ton of folks who started writing about that. And it created a huge kind of wave of support online that, I imagine the U.S. government didn't want to have to deal with. In addition to the fact that they were now going to have more legal challenges to get the information they wanted, there was also now a PR element to the whole thing. So I think it did benefit Twitter to have this public versus private. And I'm sure they would love for more of their stuff to be public if they could, because people tend to, support a company that's trying to protect its users, regardless of the reasons why.
Yeah.
So Twitter has been doing more lately to remove accounts from people, and they've been accused of violating free speech. Not by other Twitter users, very active Twitter users. Do you agree that anything that they've done, especially recently, is a violation of free speech?
So that was kind of the argument when they have suspended a few users over the years, like permanent suspension. It's pretty rare. I think Chuck Johnson was one user who was suspended. He tried to come back and with multiple accounts, and they shut him down. Breitbart's Milo, I'm going to mispronounce his last name, but Milo, who most people know him just as Milo, he got suspended about a year ago probably for kind of repeat abuse. And a lot of people at the time said, well, hey, this is just free speech. Like, if I want to go on Twitter and call someone a name or say whatever, like, I have the right to do that. And by banning these people, Twitter is trampling on those rights. I feel like I suppose I understand in principle where folks are coming from. But I also think Twitter is it's a community, right? I mean, it's a company that has user guidelines. They wouldn't allow pornography to be shared. They wouldn't allow certain racial slurs or words to be shared. And I think that as a community, you have to police yourself. Otherwise, it's going to get very aggressive and dangerous very quickly. And so I have no problem with Twitter saying, here's the line that we draw in the sand. I think the challenge is, I couldn't tell you where that line is, and I don't think any other users could. It feels to me kind of like a case-by-case basis. If there's a well-known user who repeatedly gets attention for things, Twitter has shown that they can come in and remove that person. But I think there's probably a lot of lesser-known users that do that on a regular basis that fly under the radar simply because they don't get the publicity that others do. So I don't have a problem with them saying we have standards in our community. I think that no one fully knows, because that's such a subjective thing to have. I don't think anyone fully knows where that line is, and so that's where the issue comes in.
So there's a piece over the weekend by Jenna Wortham that was in the New York Times Magazine. It was really interesting, just about how difficult it is to curb online harassment. It kind of talks about how it's rooted in the cyber libertarianism, John Perry Barlow. And what her argument is, that it's one of her many arguments, is that that because internet companies waited so long to deal with harassment, it's a more complicated problem. And I think we can all agree that even though Twitter has been better now, and like you said, it's a very difficult line, and because of their strong belief in free speech, they did, some of them, people that work at Twitter, did not do all they could to curb harassment. Do you agree that because they waited so long, the problem is more ingrained and then harder to solve?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you look at how a community is formed and how you interact with people in different parts of your life, I mean, once kind of a model is established, and once you realize kind of what's appropriate and what's inappropriate, that tends to be cemented in there. It's very hard to change, right? That's why when companies talk about an internal company culture, they'll say, hey, from the very beginning, this was a problem. And then it was harder to change as we scaled up and we grew to more employees. So I think the same thing happens with these social and online communities. And I think that when you look at why someone like a Twitter maybe didn't act earlier, I mean, user growth is a huge deal when you're looking at a publicly traded social community, right? So this Twitter, I'm sure there was a time when maybe they noticed certain things were happening, but they said, well, we can't really afford to, or at least this was the thinking, we can't afford to boot people off because we need user growth. We can't afford to eliminate all these bots because all of a sudden our users are going to look like it's way smaller than it was, and that's not good for business. The problem is, obviously, had they nipped that in the bud from the beginning, maybe they would be even bigger now because people wouldn't be avoiding Twitter because of all these issues. But this is just kind of a theory, by the way. I don't know for sure that this happened, but it makes a lot of sense. And I do think that had they started this a lot earlier, it wouldn't have created the expectation that Twitter was a place where this stuff was okay.
So you also had a piece today about Facebook buying Instagram. It was, or not today, but yesterday. It was exactly 5 years yesterday since they made the purchase. Do you think they got a good deal?
A great deal. An absolutely fantastic deal. I think when you look at, you know, $1 billion to buy Instagram at the time, I think they had 30 million users. They didn't have a single dollar in revenue. And even 5 years ago, like a $1 billion acquisition was a really big deal.
Yeah.
And so I think there were a lot of people who were like, hey, what the heck is going on? Clearly, that has been, in my opinion, one of the best, if not the best deal in Silicon Valley over the last decade. I mean, they got, I think Google buying YouTube would probably be up there too. But, you know, Instagram has 600 million users. We don't know how much money they bring in because Facebook doesn't break it out, but it seems to be that they're bringing in multiple billions of dollars a year. And if they aren't already, they certainly will be soon. So I think that from a simple metric standpoint, it was a great acquisition. But then the story kind of goes on to explain that I think one of the other reasons this was a great deal is that it showed people that Facebook and specifically Mark Zuckerberg could operate multiple kind of individual businesses at the same time. So getting Instagram and showing that, hey, it can stay independent and also grow and be successful led Facebook to getting WhatsApp and led it to getting Oculus and led it to getting someone, like David Marcus to come in and run Messenger. So I think this was the first example of Facebook being able to do multiple things at once. And that was probably a domino that helped them do all the other things that they're currently doing.
Yeah, I mean, you stole the words right out of my brain about this, just in the sense that it really seemed like the experiment with buying Instagram, because I remember when that happened, $1 billion seemed like such a crazy number that was so, and now just in comparison to what we're so used to seeing now, it's paltry, and you realize the value that Instagram has as a property for Facebook, in the sense that like people can be one and not the other. You know, some people might have problems with Facebook, but they're probably on Instagram, you know what I mean? And Facebook ultimately wins because they decided to keep them separate, foster them individually. What about this kind of conversion of functionality between the two services, though, and kind of between their other properties? It seems like a lot of new features on Facebook are also, you know, similar to new features on Instagram. Does that threaten that at all?
So I don't think it necessarily threatens users from using both. What I think that it does, though, is it definitely eliminates kind of the unique characteristics of all of these apps. So I think for a long time, Instagram felt very different than Facebook, even though it was still a photo sharing platform, right? I mean, on Facebook, you might put up 100 photos from your trip to wherever, Disneyland, and you would write about how great the trip was. And then on Instagram, you would really pick like two or three of the best ones, and that would kind of be like, here's the curated, most beautiful stuff I did. And now those two platforms have added so many features that they both have that everything has kind of come together. And I think that it's a little bit, they feel a little bit interchangeable at times. And I don't necessarily find that to be a good thing. I think I know why Facebook does it. It's because they see that certain things work on Facebook. And so they assume, well, we want, you know, everyone in Instagram to have the same experience. So they go ahead and they blur everything together. But I think that, from a use case, it just makes it harder for you as the user to decide where are you building your digital life, right? Are you going to do it on Facebook or Instagram? Do you need both of them? So far, I don't think it's been an issue for them, but I think it could kind of they could kind of compete in a weird way moving forward if this keeps happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they do things that I feel as a frequent user of both are intentionally bad for the user because they want to keep them separate. You know, on Instagram, it really, they hide whatever you write about the photo. It used to be more prominent. You could write something about a photo, but now whatever you write just looks like a comment. And I think they do that on purpose as to compare to Facebook. Like Facebook is the place where they really want you to write something about your photo. And Instagram is just for photos and scrolling fast through ads.
My guess on that, and this is a total guess, is that Instagram is pretty much exclusively a mobile service, right? So it's unlike Facebook, where I still think there's probably a good number of people who will use it on desktop, although it's clearly more mobile than desktop. But I would imagine that they're saying, hey, you know, there's only so much room on your phone screen. We're going to dedicate the vast majority of that to the actual photo or video. If you feel so compelled that you want to read something, okay, you can click, or maybe it's a little harder to find or whatever. That's a total guess, but I think you're right. I don't think that those kinds of things, in my opinion, are necessarily enough to totally distinguish the two. But I do think it is in Facebook's best interest to try and keep them a little bit separate or a little bit unique, because right now it certainly feels like they're headed in the same direction. They're going to meet in the middle somewhere. Mm-hmm.
Well, Kurt, thank you so much for joining us. Kurt Wagner is a reporter at Recode, and he is KurtWagner8 on Twitter. Have a good night.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you, Kurt. Always a pleasure. All right, feedback time. Paul writes about our discussion of pay inequalities at Google. Paul says, so I'm at an interesting point in life right now as I prepare to retire from my military career and move into the civilian workforce for basically the first time. For my whole career, my pay has been a matter of public record. So pay has never been anything of a taboo subject for the last 23 years of my life. Meanwhile, in the military, I don't think the transparency of our finances in any way diminishes our ability to function as an organization. Yeah, and I mean the core piece of that behind it all is that I think the organization fosters that, right? Like it's built from the ground up within the organization. And yet at companies, like, you never really know mm-hmm. how the company feels about that. You never really know what you're going to uncover when you start going down that road and what kind of challenges that presents itself. And so everybody, I think, kind of just bottles it up.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, feels like they can't share. They can't
right.
talk about it.
I think it's a really interesting point that the yeah. military, you know, no one would say like, oh, because everyone knows everyone's salary in the military, they're not functioning properly. Right. My husband's a teacher. It's the same thing. They know, you know, you have a certain salary scale. Right. Here's what you get. You know, if you have a degree, if you've been working this many years, it's what it is.
It's institutional.
Right.
It's just part of the institution. Yeah.
And this is just a hot take here, but the military is mostly male and school teachers are mostly female. I wonder if that has anything to do with it either way. Just saying, just throwing that out there. It's up to you to do what you will with it. TNT's fan of the day is Brett Schaefer, who says he listens to TNT while installing flooring in a house being constructed. That's awesome.
Nice.
Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we are going to find it.
We'll get you through 40 minutes of that floor installation.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've got plenty more, but mm-hmm. that's why you have Twit, the greater Twit network.
Right. So floor the whole world.
that's what I say.
Go out.
Floor the world.
Yeah. Floor the front yard. Who? Get out there.
Why not? Google's AlphaGo just can't stay away from the game Go. After all, it beat 18-time world champion Lee Sedol last year in a competition that illustrated to the world just how far artificial intelligence has come. Now, AlphaGo apparently appears to be challenging the current number one player, Qiji. Qiji has beaten Sedol a number of times before, so the robot has its work cut out for it, or does it, because artificial intelligence has another year under its belt of learning from millions of different Go, you know, videos or however, whatever they're feeding it to learn from. So I don't know. I guess there's going to be another big tournament, this time a little different. They've got three different types of matches. One is called Pair Go. Two humans are assisted by two AlphaGo instances and alternating moves with their AI teammate, basically. So they're kind of teaming up. There's Team Go, where AlphaGo plays against a team of five of the top Go players in the world. So let's see if we can get five of the top players and outsmart this AI. And then Kiji versus AlphaGo with three one-on-one matches between G and AlphaGo.
Now, one of the things that I found fascinating when AlphaGo was competing the first time is Go is this game. I don't really understand a lot of it, but I know it's an ancient game. It's been around forever, and it has like endless possibilities, right? That's what makes it different than chess. Mm-hmm. And it has a lot to do with emotion. And I mean, I know this was just a Google promo video, but it was really interesting because basically what they said was that that playing against AlphaGo made them more free. Basically, they said, you know, because AlphaGo would make a decision to a move, and they would say, like, whoa, I thought that was a mistake. Why would you do that? Because you're not a human. So, right. You know, you're just making, so it actually is making, this is the claim of Google anyway, in their promo video, that it makes, nothing's off limits. There are more possibilities. So I wonder if that can be extrapolated into other ways that we're competing against AI. Like, we'll see how an AI does something, you know, without really thinking about it, without emotion, in a good way.
Without the, like, traditional human tendencies.
Yeah.
It's almost like we're teaching the robot to play a game like a human, but no matter what, it's still a robot, and it's still going to have... it's still going to benefit from the computational brains, you know, that allow it to analyze all of these things. Is what makes it super smart, right? Mm-hmm. Is that it can probably do more of that than a human being can. So no matter what, you're still going to get a robot making calculated decisions that maybe a human wouldn't make because it's just kind of outside of their capability from a traditional sense. Mm-hmm. That's true. Probably makes the human players even better, right? Because mm-hmm. it's like, oh, I hadn't thought about that. Next time.
Yes.
Next time I'm going to do
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
But then I've never played Go, so I don't know if it translates like that. But Burke has something to say. He says, less human baggage. That's right. Us humans, we get in there and we just muck it up.
Like fear, all those things.
Yeah. No, that's true.
But
that's
fear true. Fear can have its advantages.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. TNT Records Live. Trying
Woo!
To think what the, I know. We'll throw that one out for you too. Everybody collect all of these grenades and mm-hmm. send us an email, tnt@twit.tv, and let us know what the end game is on mm-hmm. a lot of those comments. TNT Records Live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 2300 UTC at twit.tv/live. Like I said, tnt@twit.tv if you want to be part of the show, or you can leave us a voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW, and you can find us on Twitter. We're at TechNewsTodayTV.
Subscribe to the show. We're here all day, and you'll get us first if you subscribe. You can find us at twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to our technical director and video editor for today, Brian Burnett. Thanks to Burke for helping out in the studio and occasional Burke chat. Thanks to you for talking tech with us. We missed the thumbs up. It's important that we get that in there. Thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see y'all tomorrow. Bye, everybody.
Woo-hoo.